All right, everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. This is Radio. Our guest today is John Rowland. He is first and foremost a computer genius who owns a computer engineering firm called Starflight. He is also, the best I can tell, a walking encyclopedia of all things historical, political, legal, and economic. And for all I know, he's a master of kung fu, music, art, and literature, and who knows what else. Mr. Rowland is the founder of the Constitution Society and revived the Lancasterian Society. He was the Libertarian Party candidate for Attorney General of Texas in the year 2000. I voted for him. He testified before the Texas legislature about errors in government and science textbooks in 2002 and again this year. I guess they still can't get it right. He is the author of many articles about legal issues, such as Evolving Complex Networks in Constitutional Republics, Principles of Constitutional Interpretation, Intent of the 14th Amendment was to protect all rights. Public safety or bills of attainder. Let's revive private prosecutions. Sortition for judges. Original understanding of the Commerce Clause. Reverse the assumption of legitimacy. Rights of foreigners in the war on terrorism. National ID or circles of trust. Real campaign finance reform, etc., etc. You can read them all at constitution.org. Welcome to the show, sir.
I'm glad to be here.
Okay, well, since you're the founder of the Constitution Society, I suppose the subject of this interview ought to be, first and foremost, the Constitution of the United States. So, the year is 1787. Go from there.
Well, the Constitution was proposed to deal with the inadequacies of the previous arrangement, the Articles of Confederation, which were essentially a kind of diplomatic conference with no real authority to legislate for individuals. It's similar in some ways to the UN today, or to NATO, or one of the other alliances of the multiple nations. They drafted it from about June to September 17th of 1787, and then sent copies to the state legislatures, where they called conventions, popular conventions in each of the states, to actually debate and ratify it. And during the next several years, those conventions took place. And eventually all the states ratified, although some of them did so after the Constitution was adopted by the other states and the government had already started operations. Rhode Island was the last. New Hampshire was a state whose ratification threw them over the top, 9 of the 13. And after that they were able to commence operations under the new Constitution.
Is there anything to the argument that they submitted the Constitution to conventions instead of just to the state legislatures because the legislatures wouldn't have passed it and they could get it through the conventions?
No. The basic theory is that the state legislatures did not have the authority to ratify a new Constitution because that involved transfer of sovereign powers from what it were, after all, 13 sovereign states to a new central government. And their own state constitutions didn't give members of the state legislatures that authority. So they had to go back to popular conventions as the superior lawmaking body.
So what were the inadequacies, or I guess how were the inadequacies of the Articles of Confederation fixed by the new Constitution?
Well, first it allowed them to legislate directly for individuals. But only on selected subjects. And those subjects were enumerated and are intended to be interpreted fairly strictly. Most governmental authority still resided in the states, but what they tried to do is transfer to the central government those essential functions that, such as dealing with foreign nations or defense, or that needed to be done on a national level.
And wasn't the rebellion of Daniel Shays part of the impetus of creating the new Constitution? Didn't Hamilton write in the Federalist Papers that Part of the reason to create a strong new central government was so that revolutions could not spread from state to state, that they would have a national government that would be able to intervene to stop any more revolutions from happening?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. The Shays' rebellion had a certain amount of sympathy, too. They were concerned in large part about preventing the conditions that would make guys like Shays feel that he needed to rebel. So there needed to be a standard framework by which situations like that could be avoided and dealt with in the few remaining cases where they might occur. In other words, they didn't want to have people like Shays or people who led the Whiskey Rebellion be able to do so with some just cause. They wanted to remove some of the main causes of disputes. And many of them arose from the fact that the 13 states were in a more or less ongoing trade war with one another. And that led to a lot of economic chaos and contention. Simply by removing the barriers to trade with among the states, they eliminated a lot of that controversy.
What was the split after, well, actually, before the Constitution was ratified and the Federalist Papers were being written in the newspapers in New York, and there were also a strong contingent of anti-Federalists led by Patrick Henry and others who opposed ratification of the Constitution. On what grounds were they opposing it?
Well, the grounds varied. What it mostly came down to were concerns about how the Constitution would be interpreted. If you read the criticisms in the anti-Federalist papers, they're mostly criticisms of the form, well, you know, the language of this provision, which would seem to permit, you know, such and such to have to be done. And then the answer to that would be, no, no, that's not what it means, and then offered a more restricted interpretation of it. Much of what the Federalist Papers are about is answering the anti-Federalist Papers and reassuring them about how the provisions of the Constitution would actually be interpreted. So what I can see in the ratification debates was essentially hammering out this common understanding of what the constitutional provisions meant and what they didn't mean. So you shouldn't think of it as simply the pro-ratificationists, the Federalists, winning and the Federalists losing. It was really more a matter of a kind of a negotiation process in which, at least for that generation, they developed a common understanding and a mutual reassurance that the worst possible construction to the words would not be given them.
So then after the Constitution was ratified, there was a split within the Federalists between the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians. And Jefferson ended up resigning as Secretary of State and founded a whole new movement opposed to the Hamiltonian Federalists. What was that about?
Well, yes. Immediately after ratification, the Federalists now became a party of larger, more stronger central government. They started advocating things like public works and protected tariffs and other things that were not authorized by the Constitution as understood by the what came to be known as the Jeffersonians, which included Madison. However, the real crunch came when the Hamiltonians, or Federalists, adopted two important, very irritating pieces of legislation, the Alien and Sedition Acts, which are two different acts. Although in reality they didn't, the Alien Acts didn't make that much difference to most people, the Sedition Acts were immediately used to suppress a lot of the critics of the government, including many of the friends of Jefferson and Madison. In actuality, most of the worst excesses of that time were not instigated by government. It was more like the law giving a green light to the partisans of big government to take private action. For example, things like reading the mail of their opponents, which wasn't really ordered by any official, it was just done. So it was, so it became a very chaotic process. In those days, even perhaps more than today, laws were enforced by private individuals, for the most part. So an existence of a law was interpreted by the general population as a green light for everybody to go out and try to enforce that. And sometimes to over-enforce it or misenforce it. So you really had to be careful how you drafted laws, because you could be turning loose all kinds of irregular activities on the part of the general population. And that's exactly what happened. A good example of that was the Aurora, the newspaper published in Philadelphia by Benjamin Franklin's grandson and heir, which was highly critical of the Adams administration and of the Hamiltonians. And, they tried to jail him and prosecute him and do all kinds of things to them, more or less under the Sedition Act. So the response to that were resolutions in Virginia and Kentucky. The Kentucky resolutions of 1798 were drafted by Jefferson, the Virginia resolution by Madison. They were adopted by the legislatures of both states unanimously. And essentially what they did is they severely criticized the Alien and Sedition Act as unconstitutional and called on state officials not to cooperate in enforcing them. A little bit like the recent resolution of the Boston City Council to refuse to cooperate in the enforcement of the Patriot Act. So history tends to repeat itself. Well, one of the things that was interesting, of course, about the Kentucky resolutions of 1798 is that Jefferson laid out a fairly analytic approach to constitutional interpretation. And more to the particularly, he delineated the limits on criminal powers. He pointed out that the only criminal authority to criminally prosecute anyone was for treason, counterfeiting, piracy and felonies on the high seas, and offenses against the laws of nations. That's four categories. Now, he forgot to mention military discipline, but except for that last, essentially there were only four powers delegated to Congress to prosecute anyone criminally. That is, to deprive them of life or liberty or limb. In those days, limb meant corporal punishment, mainly whipping. So it was, of course, you can ask now if that was the original understanding of the Constitution in 1798. Where did all these federal criminal laws come from? And the answer is that they are all based on the Commerce Clause, or almost all of them.
Okay, well, wait a minute. Wait, before we jump ahead to 1933, I wanted to ask you about McCulloch versus Maryland and Marbury versus Madison. I always get them confused, and I never can remember which one set which precedent, which one came first. And I was wondering, I noticed that you helped explain to the writers of textbooks for school children here in Texas what these cases were really about. So I was wondering if maybe you can shed some light on those for us here.
Well, the first was Marbury v. Madison, which the actual issues in the case are not that important. A guy named Marbury was given a commission to be essentially a notary public by Adams just before Adams left office, after he lost the election, and before Jefferson had taken office. The commission had not actually been delivered to Marbury until, before Adams left office. So when Jefferson took office and appointed Madison as Secretary of State, Madison still had the commission, and Marbury sued for delivery of it so that he could proceed to exercise the duties of the office, claiming that he had a property right in the office. And Madison refused to give it to him, saying that the deal was not complete until he delivered it, and he wasn't going to deliver it. So Marbury sued under the Judiciary Act of 1789 for a writ of mandamus. That's an order to Madison to deliver him the commission so that he can start work. And Chief Justice Marshall, John Marshall, refused to grant the writ of mandamus, saying that that would violate the separation of powers of the Constitution. And he ruled that provision of the Judiciary Act of 1789 unconstitutional because it would violate the separation of powers principle. What's important, however, about the decision is not really the decision in that case, it's the opinion afterwards, what is called dictum, or in the longer term, obiter dictum, said in passing. In other words, it's commentary. So all the stuff that people quote from the case is really just commentary, a kind of a law review article, as it were. But essentially what Marshall said is that, you know, if you have a written constitution, that's supreme law, and it's our duty as judges to enforce the law, then if a statute is in conflict with the Constitution, we have to enforce the Constitution and not the statute, even though the statute occurred later. Statutes can't amend the Constitution. Now, he didn't really get into enforcement of the law by other people, but it was well understood principle at the time that enforcement of the law was everybody's duty. So essentially it meant that everybody, from the, you know, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court down to the local tavern keeper, had a duty to be able to interpret the Constitution and the laws and to resolve any conflicts that might occur in any situation in which there was a law to be enforced in their presence. Most people haven't really worked out the implications of that in their minds, but what it really means is that we all have to be experts on the Constitution. We can't delegate that job to lawyers or legal advisors, to judges, to superiors, or to anybody else. We have to do it ourselves.
Well, but isn't the claim today that Marbury versus Madison decided for all time that the Supreme Court gets to decide what's constitutional, not you or anybody else?
No, the Supreme Court never said that they had an exclusive power to decide constitutionality. It's quite clear if you read the opinion that they were only exercising a duty that is really the duty of everyone. The only thing that, of course, about the courts is they tend to get cases last.
Well, that's the way it was taught to me in college, was that in Marbury versus Madison, it was decided that the Supreme Court decides what's constitutional. And if I remember right, Jefferson said this decision ought to be trotted out before the American people and declared not law, because they were usurping, the judiciary was attempting to usurp the power from the president, the Congress, and the rest of the people of the country. Is that not right?
The problem with the Marbury decision was not the decision itself or the opinion. Marshall basically got that right. The problem is what everybody else did with it after that. You see, there was a tendency after that for everybody to say, oh, well, you know, the Supreme let the Supreme Court decide at last, therefore they're the final authority, therefore let them do it. Pass the buck to the Supreme Court. But that's not the logic of the Constitution or of the opinion, which essentially says that everybody is supposed to interpret the Constitution and apply it and resolve any conflict between it and other official acts. Yes, the courts tend to get these cases toward the end of the process, so in some sense, you know, who gets it last kind of is a little more influential in the whole process than those who get it first, but that doesn't mean that they have an exclusive power to do so. It's not the delegation of the power, it's the exercise of a duty that everybody has, which really means we're kind of all on our own.
Okay, so what's the big deal with McCulloch versus Maryland?
Well, that was the real break from constitutional compliance. The deal was that Maryland tried to tax the operations of a bank based in the District of Columbia for its operations in Maryland. And in particular, they tried to tax it at a higher rate than they taxed their own bank. And the Supreme Court under Marshall held that was unconstitutional because the bank, the national bank, was an instrumentality of the central government and therefore not subject to taxation. Now, what we're talking about essentially was a private bank and that it was owned by private stockholders, but it held the government's money and could arrange financing for the government.
Now, this is Hamilton's second bank of the United States, then?
That was the first bank, actually. This is the second bank that came later.
Oh, okay. I thought the first bank was the Constitution. It was the second bank.
I'm sorry. This was the second bank. You're correct.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thinking back to the Marbury versus Madison era, I got to move up 20 years. There was a way to reach the same decision with a better opinion. If you simply held that Maryland shouldn't tax an out-of-state bank at a higher rate than they tax their own bank, if the rate had simply been equal for everybody, then that would have been constitutional. But by overreaching and taxing them at a higher rate, in effect putting a kind of an external tariff on their operations, they did cross the line constitutionally. But the opinion was written more broadly than that. And here it provided an example of where we get into trouble with Supreme Court and other court decisions, opinions. But sometimes the opinions, which are really just commentary, I mean, there are three parts to a court decision, the written parts of it. There's the actual order, there's the finding, and then there's commentary. The commentary does not have any force of law, only the order itself and the finding do. But too often, people will later look at the commentary as though it were some kind of law in itself. This is an expansion of the doctrine of stare decisis.
And I'm sorry, the doctrine of what?
Stare decisis, the Latin term meaning let the decision stand. The idea is don't go back and relitigate old cases, just use their decisions as precedents in deciding new cases.
But what they do is, you're saying they use the commentary instead of the important part, they use the extra part to set their precedent.
Right. And sometimes that commentary would be quite broad, much broader than the issues in the actual case itself. But if you base later decisions just on that kind of broad, freewheeling commentary, you can go quite far afield from the original written authority of the Constitution itself.
And this is what they did with McCulloch versus Maryland?
Right. That was the beginning of a broader interpretation of the Commerce Clause as well. The other, in case of that sort of being Gibbons v. Ogden, in which little by little the definition of commerce was expanded, and the powers implied by the commerce power were expanded until essentially it gave the central government a virtual unlimited police powers, which it was never intended to exercise.
Okay, now this is all during the era of what they called Henry Clay's American system. You mentioned before that the Jeffersonians, part of the reason that they had split from Alexander Hamilton was the protective tariffs and subsidies to business in the North and that kind of thing. And I wonder if you could just kind of explain maybe some of the complexities of Clay's American system and what that really meant for the Constitution.
Well, Clay came along a little later. He's within the McCulloch era, but after the Marbury era. Basically, he was a follow-up to the Federalist Party itself. By that time, had already collapsed. But he represented a faction within this now one party, which later became the Whigs, which advocated stronger central government and three main programs. The first were protective tariffs, the second was a national bank, and the third were public works, financed by the central government. And the biggest public work they had in mind was the so-called National Road, which began in Cumberland, Maryland, at the end of the turnpike from Baltimore to Cumberland. It went across the Appalachian Mountains to Walling, West Virginia, where it could, the first point at which you could get on a boat down the Ohio River, and thereafter, of course, follow the Ohio River to the Mississippi and then out to the Gulf. So that was the key link to opening up the what was originally known as the Northwest Territories, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and so forth. And that road went all the way to Vandalia, Illinois, eventually. There was objected to all three of these programs that they were unconstitutional. Now, there would be constitutionally a way you could have a private bank holding government money. The problem, of course, was that the national bank had special privileges that other banks didn't have, even though they were competing in the marketplace with other banks. And that unequal treatment would be the main reason why one should object constitutionally to the national bank. There was the authority to tax, it was never intended to be used for protective purposes. It was only intended to be used to raise revenues. So to use it for a purpose other than the raising spend became a constitutional issue, particularly when it had a very severely negative effect on the economic situation of the southern states, who were often having to pay 2, 3, 4 times as much for goods from the north that they could get from England or Europe, at a much lower price, even though they had to ship it across the ocean. So it was really legislation that strongly favored one region over another. And of course, public works, Madison vetoed one public works bill just before the end of his term of office, saying there was no constitutional authority for it. But his successors, Monroe stuck to that too, but after we got to Buchanan, the resistance to it fell apart.
Maybe you can elaborate a little bit about the way that the North was favored over the South in terms of the tariffs, what effect that had on the South, and perhaps how that might have drove the war between the states.
Well, it was a principal factor motivating the war between the War of Secession, because it suppressed, well, it would be difficult to say exactly how much, but it would be fair to say that the average income of people in the southern states was probably depressed by a factor of 2 or more as a result of tariffs protecting northern industries. Because in many cases, you see, under the under the umbrella of this protective tariff, the northern businesses, many of them were virtual monopolies, were not under pressure to compete on price. And so many of them got rich, but they didn't have to really lower their costs in order to meet their competition. So the result was a great transfer of wealth from the south to the north.
And that lasted, what, till 1861?
Yeah, it had a variety of effects. One problem was that a lot of the southern, the southern economy was based on tobacco. Then when Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, it shifted to cotton. The problem with cotton is that it depletes the soil. So cotton plantation owner would find that in order to stay in business, he had to keep buying more land that hadn't been depleted yet, and he couldn't sell the old land. So he kept expanding his holdings and probably going into debt to do it. And then when you put a tariff on or increase the tariff so that he can't make enough money to repay his mortgage, then he's under a terrific, you know, stress. And that can produce all kinds of negative political impact. Of course, it's also one of the reasons why slavery was perpetuated. Ironically, the protective tariff made it very difficult not to keep slaves. If there hadn't been for the protective tariff, they might have actually been freed and thrown onto the general work, you know, general marketplace. Essentially, it kind of ratcheted the southern farmers into a position where they couldn't not keep slaves, couldn't not keep acquiring land, couldn't not keep going deeper and deeper into debt, and finally having, you know, no way out. That, of course, secession didn't really solve their problems, but it could not have solved their problems, but it was certainly the great irritant.
Okay, well, this is a little bit off of history and politics, more to the philosophy angle. I think Abraham Lincoln has been accused of kind of replacing what had been American principles based on John Locke more with the Thomas Hobbes model of government as far as the social contract and that kind of thing goes. I wonder if you can explain.
Well, I wouldn't lay that on Hobbes. The alternative to Locke and the Lockean model would really be the monarchistic philosophies. We don't attach them to an hereditary monarch, but rather to mercantilist interests, then you can begin to get a more of a sense of the political conflict involved. Hobbes was a little pessimistic about people being able to govern themselves. But a lot of his pessimism, if you read his other writings, was really more of an accommodation to the existing political situation. He didn't want to be labeled as a rebel and have his head cut off, which had happened to a lot of other people. So he kind of toned down his really very Republican writings. Locke came along a little bit later and could feel a little freer to say what he thought, although even he published essentially at the end of his life when it was safe to do so. One of his colleagues, Algernon Sidney, got into trouble while he was still alive and got his head cut off, although on the basis of chapters of his book, Discourses on Government, which had not been published yet, but they were published posthumously. So it was dangerous to write on these subjects back in those days. You were taking your life in your hands to do so. And there was a natural tendency, of course you can see it also in Hobbes, you know, every other sentence is a reference to the Bible, which he tried to, you know, justify all of his statements by biblical references, some of which are, you know, a little tenuous. But you were told, you know, wrap yourself in the Bible sort of thing in order to keep your head from being lopped off.
Okay, well, if we don't pick on Hobbes too much personally, there's still the difference between John Locke says, hey, it's a contract, but the government exists by a social contract, and either side can end the contract when they feel like it, where Hobbes said that, hey, once you sign the contract, buddy, you signed it. Even if it was your grandparents or great-grandparents that signed it, once you create a government, you don't have the right to, in this case, secede from the Union anymore. And that was the position that Abraham Lincoln took. Isn't that right?
Well, because I don't think you can really say that Lincoln was looking back to Locke and Hobbes when he did that. He was had more of a vision of a vast federal republic that would keep expanding in size and power, and he didn't want it to be split, you know, and he didn't, in particular, to have an ongoing war, because, you know, it wouldn't be just a matter of letting them go. There's also a question about who owns all those western territories. So war would have been inevitable if for no other reason than it was over control of the western territories. And but the real factors that drove that were psychological. When Beauregard attacked Fort Sumter, he so inflamed public opinion in the North, which had previously been willing to let the South go, that after that, no Northern politician was expected to win an election to do anything else than try to punish the South and take the South back. If it had just not been for that one incident, the secession probably would have succeeded.
Yeah, you know, I don't say that. I know how popular perception can be, and I don't say that to defend slavery or anything like that, but it just seemed that, you know, when I read history and I see the way the North invaded and conquered the South, I wonder whether that was really necessary at all.
Well, it was a tragic period. It could so easily have been avoided. Of course, a lot of what the South was demanding was irrational. Yeah, their ordinances of secession complained mainly about non-enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Clauses, the Fugitive Slave Act. They interpreted that they required that slave owners should be able to go up north and retrieve their slaves without judicial process. And since some blacks were free and some weren't, the northern states were saying, you know, no way, we need to figure out through a trial whether or not this really is your slave, because he might be a free citizen. I've been born and raised here and not have any connection with you at all. So we have to decide this in the trial. Well, of course, the trial makes it very expensive. A trial is decided by a jury, and the jury is just, we're not returning blacks to the South no matter what, even if the slave owner did have a claim. And most of the time, how could he prove that he was his slave? You know, what evidence that you have is yours. So it's not as though they had serial numbers. So
yeah, they didn't invent that until later.
And they also, the problem, the Underground Railroad was really getting going. A lot of slaves escaping wholesale. And the southern plantation owners just discovered that there was no way the slaves were economically viable if you had to keep guards them chained all the time and guards over them all the time. So, you know, you couldn't keep them economically, keep them from escaping, and if they escaped, then you were done for economically. But the fact is that even if they had seceded, they still have, you know, 2,000-mile border, which was indefensible. There was no way they could have held on to them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. What advantage did the Southerners see in seceding from the Union to solve that problem? That seems like it just made it harder to get their escape slips back.
Purely an emotional outburst. It was totally irrational.
Well, and we are talking about people who own other human beings, so how rational can we really expect them to be?
Well, I think that sort of thing certainly has a corrosive influence on rationality. But ultimately, what it comes down to is that was irrational behavior on their part. And of course, they had a good constitutional argument. The problem is that by mingling it with slavery, they have tainted the constitutional argument, and they both went down together.
Yeah, the same thing kind of that Governor Wallace and those guys did with the arguments for states' rights in the 60s.
So yeah, the Civil Rights Act of 64 was unconstitutional for the most part, because it tried to extend the protections against deprivations of rights from state agents, which the 14th Amendment allows, to private agents, which it does not. And, you know, so it was clearly a usurpation of power. Arguably, it did have some useful effects. I remember my mother was in the real estate business in the during that time frame. And, you know, if she wanted to, you know, sell a house to a black or Hispanic family, and anybody objected, she could just, you know, point to this act and say it's illegal. You know, I can't discriminate. Of course, she didn't want to discriminate anyway, but she could use the act as cover for doing the right thing. And there was very little actual enforcement under that act. The single greatest impact on it was this kind of moral impact by changing the moral and legal climate. So, in that sense, it was a good thing, but it was unconstitutional.
Well, and in bringing up the 14th Amendment, that takes us right back to the end of the Civil War. In fact, here, I have my Constitution here. I ought to flip to the 14th Amendment and make sure I get it right here. Let's see. Yes, July 9th, 1868. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, this, to me, is a very puzzling thing in a number of ways. I guess it can't really be argued that at the end of the Civil War, without a 14th Amendment like this, the southern states would have gone right ahead and deprived people of whatever rights they felt like, as long as those people were brown who were getting their rights taken away. But my question is, really, you know, in the preamble to the Bill of Rights and in the language of the Bill of Rights, and then especially in the Ninth Amendment, it's made clear that the Bill of Rights in the United States Constitution is a list of declaratory and restrictive clauses that forbid the national government from doing certain things. Whereas the Texas Bill of Rights, for example, says the state of Texas must protect your right to free speech, must protect your right to be secure in your house. The national government is simply forbidden from interfering with it. And then now, I guess the way this 14th Amendment has been interpreted through the last century is to turn the Bill of Rights from a list of restrictions against federal power into really a grant of power to the Justice Department to protect individual rights from a state. Is that correct?
Well, the last or fifth clause of the 14th Amendment delegates power to Congress to implement, to enforce the rest of the amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're right. This thing does go on and on. I just stopped at the end of section
one. That was a key factor. It doesn't actually define which rights may be protected. And in principle, Congress could pass legislation to protect some and not others. The reason why that was necessary was that in Article 3 of the Constitution, it lists the kinds of controversies over which federal courts have jurisdiction. It really just says Supreme Court has jurisdiction, and then lumps all other lower courts into, you know, another category without specifying them individually. And it says the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction in some cases and appellate jurisdiction in others, and then allows Congress to redistribute appellate and original jurisdiction between them. But what it omits are cases between a citizen and his own state. And then the 11th Amendment removes jurisdiction between cases between a state and a citizen of another state. Now, what that was intended to do was really to prevent people from suing a state for a large amount of money damages and executing directly on their assets. Later decisions have restricted that somewhat, pointing out that legislative history didn't really intend to cover injunctive or declaratory relief. But then the situation arises, if a state deprives its citizens of rights and they can't get redress in the state courts, should they be able to go to federal court and treat it as what's called a federal question? Now, there's some controversy as to whether the Bill of Rights originally applied to the states in the sense of being rights that the states had to recognize. In my view, based upon my historical analysis of it, they did apply to the states. What they didn't do is extend the jurisdiction of federal courts to cases between a citizen and his own state. That was what they didn't clearly do.
Well, then, now, so in what matter did they apply to the states if there was no federal jurisdiction to enforce it?
Well, then it would be up to the state courts to say, to refer to the national constitution in reaching their own decision.
I see.
In other words, allow a state citizen to plead in a state court the federal Bill of Rights. And, you know, in the constitution it says that the judges of every state are bound by this constitution. So
okay,
the rights, so the rights applied, they just wasn't enforceable by federal courts. And after the 14th Amendment, they were.
Okay, now I saw something on TV, a documentary on the Justice Files or who knows what, where they were interviewing a retired Supreme Court justice who I don't believe is alive anymore. I think his name was Brennan.
Brennan.
And he was one of the justices who sat on the court during the, during the Thurgood Marshall era, during what they called the incorporation of the Bill of Rights, where case by case, they applied the first, and noticeably they skipped the second, but the fourth and the fifth and sixth amendments to the states, case by case. And this Supreme Court justice was explaining that they never used the 14th Amendment as their legal justification for deciding these cases. That really, in their view, the 14th Amendment was too vague and did not transfer that kind of authority to them. But what they were doing was saying, you know what, it's just that important, we don't care. And so I wonder if you can like reconcile those two things for me. Was it or was it not the 14th Amendment that allowed the national government to incorporate the National Bill of Rights against the states?
Well, I think that Justice Brennan was describing his own mental processes more than that of his colleagues. They would have to have spoken for themselves, which they did in some of their points, their opinions. And in their opinions, they did cite the 14th Amendment. So they at least thought about it enough to put it in their opinions. Actually, as I read the legislative history of the Bill of Rights, the only right that was really restricted to the federal government was the First Amendment, because Madison, in his proposed amendments, had two amendments, one restricting the U.S. Congress and the other restricting the states with otherwise similar language. And when it got to committee in the Senate and the House, they approved the one for the central government but not for the states. But all the other amendments were worded in a way that would seem to apply to both central and state governments. And the reason why they were, because they were conceived of as rights that belonged to people before a government was ever created. They're rights that arise either out of the state of nature or out of the social contract. before government was created, before the constitutions were adopted, either state or national. And the principle of law of understood at that time was that original rights prior to the Constitution are as enforceable as any others. That rights don't come from constitutions, they come from the state of being before the Constitution was adopted.
All right, you're listening to John Rowland. He is the founder of the Constitution Society. You can look him up at constitution.org. We're going to take a little break and play a song and come right back. This is the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, administrator. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew. We continue now with John Rowland, the founder of the Constitution Society. Pardon me. All right, Mr. Rowland, I guess we can go ahead and move on into the 20th century now. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the Supreme Court, the packing of the Supreme Court during the New Deal and what was going on there. I know that's a lot to do with the Interstate Commerce Clause and its continued expansion.
Well, there was a steady erosion of compliance with the Constitution going back even further than that. The so-called packing of the Supreme Court didn't actually occur. It was threatened, and it was in 1937 that there was a sudden shift in the philosophy of the judges of the Supreme Court, according to which they now then started to pretty much rubber stamp everything that the Roosevelt administration did. Before that, they had been overturning most of what it had been trying to do. But one can see a progression. For example, it wasn't until 1884 that Congress adopted any legislation creating criminal penalties under the authority of the Commerce Clause. That was a small fine for transporting tainted meat across a state line. And that was sustained by the Supreme Court, which opened the door to making criminal powers an implied power of the regulatory power, which previously had not been considered to be. That led from case to case. Essentially, the way it worked out is that it started out with state laws being overturned because they were in conflict with federal laws under the Commerce Clause. Then they started striking down state laws and official actions which were not in conflict with any regulations passed by Congress, but which interfered with commerce between the states. In other words, it no longer depended on conflict with the federal regulations.
Now, the first one there, that was okay, right? The Supremacy Clause says that if a state law and a national law conflict, the national law wins. You're saying
right.
Now they're overruling states when their state law doesn't necessarily conflict with a national law.
Yeah, McCullough was actually an example of that, in a sense, because there was not actually a federal statute that it was in conflict with. But other decisions made that point more clearly. And over a period of, over a succession of these precedents, it got to the point where anything that interfered with interstate commerce could be made illegal and punished by criminal penalties. And then the definition of commerce started increasing. The original definition was only intended to include transfers of ownership and possession of tangible commodities across from one state to another. It didn't include transporting your own property. It didn't include transporting yourself. It didn't include anything except a combination of a transfer of ownership and of possession from one state to another or to a foreign country. Or I should say from a foreign country to a state, because there was no tax on exports. But the power to regulate was never intended to imply the criminal powers. In other words, it was intended to be enforced only by deprivations of property, essentially as a civil matter, not as a criminal matter. So it was the introduction of the criminal power that really began the downhill slide. And this led ultimately to the case of Wickard v. Filburn in 1942, which prosecuted a farmer criminally under the Agricultural Adjustment Act for consuming his own grain, which was subject to price and production control, under the theory that it had a, quote, substantial effect on interstate commerce.
Yeah, it sounds like a federal felony to me, eating your own grain.
Yeah, well, that was the foundation for all of the federal criminal laws, that are almost all of them, that we see on the books today.
So that goes for even drug laws and gun laws, and all these things come under the Interstate Commerce Clause?
That's right. And the argument always is that the offender is interfering with interstate commerce. Even when they prosecuted Timothy McVeigh for killing 8 federal agents, it was because the killing of the agents had an impact on interstate commerce.
Nice. Wow, so what's the point of having a constitution and a rule of law if the words in the constitution just mean whatever the hell they want them to mean instead of what they say?
Well, exactly. And, of course, in my view, that we need to stick to the original meanings. And if there's any doubt as to what the words mean, then in interpreting power, they should be given the most restrictive possible meaning. And then when interpreting a right, they should be given the broadest possible meaning. That might be what you call the libertarian presumption, which was basically the presumption of Madison and Jefferson and those guys. Powers were to be interpreted restrictively, rights interpreted broadly. It is the ancient principle of quo warranto, what is the authority? If an official tried to exercise some power and somebody objected to it, it was up to the official to prove by an unbroken logical chain of authority going back to the Constitution that he had the authority to do that. And if he couldn't provide that proof, then he had to stop doing it or not start.
Well, what do you say to a average Democrat or Republican voter who says, oh, come on, you know, how are we going to, we're going to amend the Constitution every time we want to create the FAA or every time we want to, you know, give prescription drugs to seniors or this and that. Look at the Texas Constitution. It's 500 million pages long because you have to amend it every time you want to change it at all. And don't you know we have a living Constitution and it's deliberately broad so that we can change these things without having to go through the painful process of amending the Constitution every time.
Well, take the FAA for example. Now, I'll admit it is more rational to regulate air traffic on a national level. You know, it'd be kind of a hassle to have to look up a different set of rules every time you cross from one state to another. However, there's no reason why, for example, the states couldn't all agree to just cede to the Congress exclusive jurisdiction over airspace above, let's say, 1,000 feet above clear of terrain obstacles. That would make airspace, you know, above a certain altitude, federal territory over which Congress would then have authority. Now, that would make sense.
So right now, it's not like that. It's not considered their territory. It's just considered under their jurisdiction because they feel like it.
That's right. Now, something like FCC regulations, well, there's no authority for that.
Hell,
they're not tangible commodities. It does make some sense to allocate bandwidth to avoid everybody with a stronger transmitter stomping on everybody with a weaker transmitter. But, of course, sir, that could be handled through a system of nuisance litigation. But again, the guys with the most deepest pockets would tend to win. So regulation does make some sense, provided that it doesn't prevent anybody from broadcasting that does not interfere with anybody else. But, again, there's no authority for it, so that would take a constitutional amendment.
Well, and I was kind of hoping you'd say it's supposed to be difficult to amend the Constitution. You know, if Congress
yes,
can just pass a law and amend the Constitution by statute, well, then look how quickly we live in a total state. And if
we have to take
the time to get it through three-quarters of the state legislatures and two-thirds of both houses of Congress, that, you know, maybe
yes.
the stupid ones won't get passed and only the good ones will make it through.
Yeah, well, some of the... So the ones that have been proposed in recent years are pretty stupid. We don't seem to have the quality of statesmen now that we had in the early days of the Republic, even as far as their drafting skills and drafting amendments. They tend to be political statements that are very poorly constructed. And whether you agree with them or not, they're just not good legal draftsmanship. But, yes, it's supposed to be difficult, and it should be difficult, and the federal government should probably not be doing most of the things that it does. It should be left to the states, or they shouldn't be done at all. There's no reason, for example, why the federal government needs to prosecute, you know, CEOs for stock fraud or insider trading or any of these other things. It has no authority to do that. The states can do it. And what you discover, though, is that the big corporations actually want the central government to preempt that role because they can use it to suppress their small competitors, and it's easier to compromise one SEC than 50 state SECs.
Oh, but I thought all this anti-government propaganda was all just the propaganda of big business that's trying to fool us into letting them do whatever they want.
No. Most federal regulation is supported by big business because it helps the state by small business. That's what the railroads and other big corporations discovered in the late 19th century and why you have the Interstate Commerce Commission and all these other regulatory activities. Regulations tend to be less costly per unit of production for a big company than for a small one. And for a small one, or a new company entering the market, they can be prohibitively expensive. So if it's essentially it works to give the big companies a greater advantage than they would otherwise have and to prevent the entry into the market of new competitors.
Mr. Rowland, I'd like to ask you, you know, I understand, you know, the whole libertarian precept of free market capitalism, free exchange, no tariffs, free trade, private property rights, that kind of basic American principles of liberty. At the same time, I'm listening to this story here, and it seems to me that the first generation or two of Americans that got rich immediately became socialists and got on welfare and had Henry Clay pay their way for them, and that really we've lived in this unconstitutional system that, you know, the limited republic that protected private property rights allowed these people to accumulate enough wealth to buy off the state and retain power more or less ever since.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call it the first generation.
Well,
more
yeah,
like
I
it,
really
more,
mean after it, by the time the founders were dead, the next their
yeah.
sons.
Yeah, more like their grandkids, but about the third generation. That's when it really started falling apart.
So this seems to be a really big flaw in the whole private property rights and free market capitalism and whatever. If these people way back then could have got so rich to buy the central government and use it for their ends all this time, was this a flawed concept in the beginning?
Well, there is a problem with large organizations. The free market works best when the competitors are approximately the same size. But if one or a few start getting much bigger than the others, they can start manipulating the market in a way that the others are driven out of business.
Right, and then we cry for them to be regulated to stop them from being like that, and then, like you say, they're the ones who control the regulations to protect them from the little guy. So what is to be done?
Well, I think the real solution would be more aggressive antitrust action, but antitrust action at an earlier stage. We now don't start applying it until a real monopoly emerges. But what would really be a good idea, in my view, although, again, the Constitution doesn't provide authority for it, for government action to achieve it, would be for, you know, any time a company in a field gets larger than, say, three times the size of its nearest competitor, it gets broken up into three parts. So you just keep breaking it up, breaking them up, breaking them up. You're not really depriving anybody of any wealth. You're just changing the management structure. You can still have the same people owning shares of stock in the products of the breakups. And if we broke up Microsoft, Bill Gates would still have so many percent share of each of the components. But they would be forced to compete as separate management, separately managed operations.
So there's really not a free market way to take down monopolies? Because it seems like they tried this. They said, hey, let's have some antitrust laws. And they did it 110 years ago, and look where we're at. It didn't do any good at all.
Well, it did do some good, but not enough. And there is, as I said, there's a problem with the federal government stepping in to being a litigant in an antitrust action. Because it doesn't really have the authority to represent the injured parties in a case like that. I could create a jurisdiction for private parties to sue and to sue successfully, and that would be the way to go. In other words, let the competitors of Microsoft sue Microsoft, and let the courts be neutral arbiters in the disputes. So the problem is that the classic models of economics don't really apply to the real world. Not the libertarian or Smithian models, and not the socialist models, and nobody's models do. The real world is more complicated than our various models contemplate. But the reality is that the rich do get richer for a variety of reasons, and would even if there were no government. Now, economies of scale is only part of it. There's also a factor of a kind of a natural herd mentality on the part of people to flock toward the biggest, and the strongest, the most powerful, the most convenient. You know, why do people go to Walmart? Well, it's not just because the prices are lower. They may be somewhat lower, but they may not be lower on everything. But it's simply more convenient to go to one place where they don't have to think about whether the prices are lower, because they probably are lower on the average than most of the others. It saves them the burden of having to price every product on a product-by-product basis, and maybe running all over town to try to get the best deal. So in that situation, you'll tend to have a single competitor getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and squeezing all of the others out of business. You know, when I was a boy, most businesses were small. You had a few big ones like Sears Roebuck or, of course, the oil companies or the railroad companies. But the average retail vendor was a locally owned operation. And somewhere along the way, most of them became national chains. And in my view, that's not a healthy situation, particularly when it comes to things like banks and lending institutions, financial institutions. Just too have too much power aggregating into too few hands. But on the other hand, you can't really afford to keep your businesses small if you're operating in a world market where entire countries are essentially big corporations. You'd almost have to have some kind of antitrust activity at the global level for in order for this to work. How do you compete? How does, you know, local electronics company compete against Japan Incorporated? You know, so it's...
Well, and then you say something like, let a world government solution to solve that problem. That brings... I found something when I was searching on your resume on the internet that... And I know this is back in the 70s, so I'm not saying this like as any kind of aspersion to you or anything, but I see that you went and traveled around Europe trying to create... I don't remember the name of the association, but trying to work to create International Federal Union?
Yes.
And you and I have discussed before how, really, I guess sort of what you were just getting at, that really the only way to really have basically fair and free market is to have a world government thing that can protect ma and pa business in some little country against Japan Incorporated. So... I really want to get to the bottom of that as far as, you know, you're the head of the Constitution Society, so I can't see there's anything in the Constitution that gives the Congress the power to delegate their authority to supranational institutions.
There isn't.
Where's the trade between sovereignty and free trade? And
well, of course, my concept was that we get all these countries together in a conference, and then they, of course, argue about the difficulties of creating a new federal union. It says, well, you know, we've already got one, the United States of America. Let's all apply for statehood. And then have an orderly process for becoming states.
Oh, really? Make the whole world states in our union?
That's right.
Cool. Well, we wouldn't have the same constitution no more, though, you know?
Well, actually, it would be the same constitution. We might add a few amendments, but there's no reason in principle why the Constitution of the United States of America couldn't be the Constitution for the world, eventually.
Yeah, except that they would hate it and hate us for trying to force it on them.
Well, they're not ready for it, but until they are ready for it, we wouldn't want to admit the mistakes anyway. We got a long way to go before that's going to be a good idea. But at least we can start thinking about it.
Has your view changed since then, or you still think that really world government's the solution in the end, but just the end?
Well, I think some kind of world government would be. I mean, it's a rational thing to do. Whether human beings are rational enough to make it work, however, is an open question. I would say that until human beings globally evolve socially and culturally and in every other way to the point where they're ready to make it work, that is not a good idea. And at the rate they're going... it could be another 1,000 years. And it's a little difficult to imagine us becoming a star-faring species, you know, traveling among the stars and creating a galactic empire and still have 180 sovereign nations back on Earth.
Yeah, I guess as long as there's somebody to compete with.
Well, of course, one thing is, though, that needs to be pointed out, but getting back to John Locke, is that... the legitimacy of the social contract rests upon people remaining within the territory of the society when they reach the age of majority, which means that they have to have someplace else to go, or the social contract loses its legitimacy. So if there is a world government, it could never be a government for the entire world. There would always have to be some place that people could go if they didn't assent to the social contract.
Which is the basic reason that the people in this country and around the world who oppose the current different brands, perhaps there are different brands of globalism, but the current globalist movement around the world is opposed by so many people because they know that there will be nowhere else to run to. If we ever have, like it says on the UN's website, how they want to have a permanent world standing army, how's any sovereign nation ever going to be able to resist domination from a single world military?
Yeah, well, of course, following counter also is that the the political classes of the United States and of other countries have their own ideas, their own agenda for international federation. And my own efforts were pretty effectively thwarted. These other guys moved in and took over the work that I and my other friends had done. And it wasn't until later that I began to realize what had really happened, that it was, you know, as soon as we became powerful enough to become a factor, they came in and took us over. You know, they never intended that there should be a constitutional federal union. They intended that for it to be a under the control of the, you know, the wealthy and powerful. So that's another problem we have, is that is it safe to unite nations today, or for that matter, even to keep the nations we've got, with the political classes that we have now dominating them? Or for that matter, to make any amendments or to make many other changes in government? At this, we're at a very difficult stage in history where there is a kind of an upper class that stands in the way of any kind of meaningful, rational reform, simply because no matter what anyone tries to do, they're going to take it over and bend it to their own interests.
Wow, and you bring up two really good questions. First, I want to know about this they that you're referring to, more particularly who these people are and how do you know about them so well. And secondly, what you just said about whatever it is you got, they'll come in and co-opt it and use you as the pressure from below to justify what they already want to do anyway. And
yep.
And we see this, I see it especially with the left-wingers in the street who hate the World Trade Organization because it doesn't regulate enough, that it ought to have more power over the environment and labor and et cetera all over the world, and so therefore they're against it. And meanwhile, inside the meeting, all the Western leaders are saying, you know, we ought to listen to those hippies out in the street. They know what they're talking about. We should expand our power. Thanks a lot, guys. And I wonder, you know, the libertarian argument is pretty good. Hey, deregulate and let's have a free market. And what they end up doing is they keep the regulations that say that we, the taxpayer, have to bail them out, but they get rid of the regulations that keep them from going so deep into the red.
That's right.
So, first, the question of, I guess, the they and the elite, and maybe if you can just describe the structures and the institutions that you're talking about, and then if you can address that pressure from above and below where all good arguments are co-opted and used to bring us more towards statism.
Yeah, well, it's a difficult problem. There are no easy answers. What it really requires is a political culture in which every individual devotes maybe an hour or two a day to public affairs, and in which power is distributed very, very broadly, is not concentrated in a few hands anywhere, and in which people are making enlightened decisions for what's good for the country and society and world as a whole instead of for what are the private pocketbooks. The trouble is that human beings are not quite at that, have not quite evolved to that point. They're capable of it. They're right on the edge of being evolved far enough, but they don't have the tendencies to fulfill that potential. At their best, human beings that exist today are magnificent, but they're usually not at their best. They're usually just mucking around, you know, jockeying for personal advantage. And that can be fatal to us all. And, well, yes, you can say things like leadership might be part of the solution, but, you know, in today's world, how does one effectively lead people who are all in it for themselves?
Well, you appeal to their selfishness and say, hey, you want to be free, right? Well, if you deserve liberty, then everybody else does too.
Well, so that doesn't really work either. They have to have a higher, more principled attachment to those values. Simply freedom for oneself can be achieved by denying it to other people. Everybody can imagine that he will escape the strictures that he's advocating for others. It probably won't be true, but they can imagine it until it's too late. No, what worked before, interestingly enough, was religion. Religion was the main factor in the early days of the Republic, encouraging people to take a more high-minded approach to public affairs. But in reality, of course, it worked best during the Revolutionary era. And once prosperity began to set in, prosperity can be very corrupting. People seem to be better at their best when they're not too prosperous, not too poor either. Either corrupts them or makes them desperate. I think one of the reasons why the Swiss have maintained a fairly high level of civic virtue over the centuries is because they live in a country where it's possible for everybody to have enough, but not too much. And everybody has to work very, very hard to just, maintain a minimum standard of living. And there haven't really been a lot of opportunities for a few people to get very, very rich, except some of the bankers. So the circumstances of life can have a great impact over all of that.
Okay, now the question about they. In particular, you talked about how your movement, which I think is great, to get Europe and all those guys to become states in the American Union, how that was co-opted and destroyed and used for other purposes by some group of theys. I wonder if you can elaborate on that and explain what was going on.
Well, it would be difficult. It would take a long story to tell what happened, but essentially what we did, it was an existing organization with its own body of supporters. I've been kind of keeping the idea alive for a long time. And their idea was essentially to call an Atlantic Convention to draft a constitution to be proposed to the various participating nations for adoption. And in fact, such a resolution was adopted and a convention held in 1964, I think it was, under the Johnson administration. Well, they didn't do anything. All they did is just refer it back to the various foreign ministries to work out the, a closer working relationship between the countries. Because the fact is that you don't get people committed to drafting a new constitution appointed that way. Not in today's world. None of the participants were the kind of people who had a clue how to draft a constitution. They were the kind of people who always had staff people do everything for them. And so their natural tendency, whenever they were called upon to produce a document, is to refer it to staff. So you can't send people like that into a convention without the document having already been written. They're only good for rubber stamping previously done work. And the people behind the movement at that time just didn't understand that. So because they were kind of, let's say, ossified, we decided to start with a new beginning and to set up, local grassroots chapters in the various countries, but to start with a fairly high level of support. So we got 22% of the members of the U.S. Congress to sponsor this new organization and to sponsor a letter to their colleagues in the then 12 Democratic NATO nations. So we were busily putting out letters in the various national languages to several hundred members of parliament and collecting their replies, and we got roughly 22% of the members of the parliament, so the other nations. Some countries a little higher, Turkey, some a little lower, France, but, it was similar percentages, roughly a fifth. Then we held an organizing conference in Ditchley, England, which is a famous conference center. And it was kind of interesting because that's when we got the first appearance of an interloper, a guy who claimed to be from Jamaica, who demanded to be recognized as a delegate from Jamaica, who I was able to learn was a Soviet agent. But he generally tried to interfere with our organizing efforts. After the conference, and I went around Europe visiting members of parliaments who had been our supporters to discuss setting up local national chapters, which was led to some interesting encounters, and I learned a lot from that experience. The general word that I got from most of them was that Europe needed to unite first before it was ready to unite with the United States. That the United States was playing a critical role in the world, that it couldn't be disturbed by, you know, becoming involved in something like that. That there were too many problems of uniting nations that had to be worked out first, and that it would be better to let the Europeans work it out among themselves, and then when they had cleared away the obstacles, then they could talk about union at a higher level, which of course made some sense.
Which is apparently what's going on right now.
Exactly, yes. However, if you look at the proposed constitution for a European Union, you immediately see some of the problems, because it reads like a political tract, as the constitution is terribly drafted. And you have to just imagine yourself a judge trying to make a legal decision in an actual court case based upon the provisions of a constitution like the one they've written. And it's so vague as to be meaningless. There are no procedures, no structure, no rights as we know them, all sorts of entitlements, which are not really constitutional rights, vague proclamations of principle without any real clear guidelines as to how to interpret them in practice. And it enshrines that bureaucracy as the real power. And of course, the bureaucracies, as we all know, are controlled generally by special interests who is one of whose primary activities is to get their people placed in key positions in the bureaucracy. So you have the real government being outside of government itself, off to the side, exercising power by pulling strings within the executive branch structure.
This is all scaring the hell out of me. You're saying you wanted to become a federal union with these people? I thought, you know, I'm all about the Declaration of Independence from Europe and no entangling alliances. And I think, you know, here we are, America's becoming more and more like Europe every day, and I don't see them becoming more like us.
Well, unfortunately, that's the impression I got, too. And at this point, the only country in Europe that I would be willing to admit as a state would be Switzerland.
So what happened then to this? Besides the Soviets trying to come in and mess you guys up, was it powerful interests in America that undercut you?
Well, it was, as soon as it looked like we might start being a real political force, because we were moving along pretty well, we suddenly had a lot of people who decided to join, and because they represented, you know, fairly significant interest to be on the board. As soon as they got a majority on the board, they started voting, you know, in a way that essentially, reduced us to impotence. And of course, one of their primary objectives was to squeeze me out. Suddenly, I had no more positions. I was seen as the major threat.
Because you had read John Locke?
Well, because I was really the intellectual leader of the whole process. And, of course, the youngest member also. The other guys were older guys who weren't going to be around much longer. So I was the heir apparent to the movement, as it were. And, of course, because I had my own agenda, which was a constitutional federal republic, as opposed to a oligarchic one. But the takeover was very subtle. A lot of people imagine Washington has elsewhere as a hotbed of conspiracies, but the way it actually happens is remarkably subtle. Even if you were a fly on the wall videotaping everything that went on, you wouldn't necessarily detect the conspiracies that go on there. The subtlety of it is amazing. But it is quite real. But as I said, it was a great education. I think that it's still basically a good idea, but as I said, we probably have hundreds of years of evolution before we're going to be ready for anything like that. Barring, of course, an invasion from outer space or something. Then all bets are off, but it's just, human nature is modified by the various national cultures is kind of dismal. I mean, like I said, human beings at their best can be great, but most of them are not at their best most of the time. And it's very possible that the kind of polity envisioned by the founders of the United States may not be sustainable over the long term with human beings as they are. Human beings in the revolutionary era may have been conditioned by that experience in a way that is unique in history and that may never occur again.
Have it as our legacy and our history.
Well, I, for one, it lives in me, and as long as I'm alive, there's hope.
Yeah.
And if everybody takes the same attitude and says, to heck with it, the rest of you, I'm going to enforce the Constitution as originally understood. I'm going to conduct my life as though it were full force in effect. And if I run into any conflict with the rest of you guys, well, we will see who's still standing when the dust settles.
And you know, it ought to be stated here for the people who went to government school and are therefore functionally illiterate in the audience that the Constitution's only, depending on the size of the print that you're reading, 5 or 6 pages long. Take you less than an hour, including when you have to go and look up writ of mandamus and bill of attainder in your dictionary to make sure you know what those mean. Maybe take you to really study it a couple of hours of your time.
Well, of course, to really understand it does take longer than that. I don't want to kid anybody. I converse with constitutional scholars every day, and a lot of them are unclear on the key concepts. So sometimes too much learning can lead people astray, especially if they have political agendas. But realistically, to fully understand the Constitution and what it requires of us is going to require, let's say, 10 or 15 minutes a day for most of one's life. Which is not a whole lot out of a person's life, but it does require some attention.
Sure, and hey, 15 minutes a day, liberty is worth it, no doubt. I got to ask you something on a totally different subject. Well, not a totally different subject, obviously, it's all interconnected. But I read on the internet that you have some personal knowledge about the Waco incident, massacre of back in 1993, 100 miles or so north of here. And I was wondering if maybe you could share that anecdote with us here.
Well, of course,
or maybe you have
like many people, I was upset about what happened at Waco. I was in California at the time. Then a contract brought me to California, back to Texas, to San Antonio, in time for the trial. And as it turns out, my client had us working in the building, the Tower Life building, which was within sight of the federal courthouse, and in which both the prosecution and defense rented office space and hired temporary workers to, you know, do their staff work on the case. And, you know, we had people monitoring the trial, and I put up reports on the trial on the Internet, and I was in touch with the people in both camps. Got copies of most of the paperwork, and I did things like put the judge's instructions to the jury on the Internet before the jury got them, which I think got a few people upset, because it clearly showed that the judge was manipulating the jury to get his guilty verdict.
How so?
Well, basically, the defense approach was to make it an affirmative defense. In other words, a self-defense, that the Davidians had a right to defend themselves. Normally, in most courts, you don't have to make a motion to make an affirmative defense. You simply give notice that you're going to make an affirmative defense. That's considered appropriate so that the prosecution has a chance to, you know, have due notice and prepare their case on their side. But the federal judge required them to make a motion for an affirmative defense and then denied the motion, which is almost unheard of. In effect, saying you can't defend them.
Saying that they could defend them but not use the idea that they were defending their own lives and shooting
right.
The ATF agents.
Right. All they could do is just, you know, try to refute the evidence presented by the government that on their side. And, of course, because the judge knew he couldn't really get away with it, because they could file what's called a memorandum of information to present their evidence for the record, which would give them an almost unbeatable case on appeal to have it overturned, said, okay, if you'll agree not to file your evidence, I'll include an instruction to the jury that they can decide on self-defense. Now, I won't let you present any evidence of self-defense or any argument on self-defense, but I'll let you put an instruction to the jury. But you have to forego introducing your evidence. And the defense decided to go with that. They thought it was the best deal they could get, because they thought that the jury would be smart enough to see through the government's case and seize on the self-defense point.
But really, the only way they could get to it during the trial would be during the cross-examination of the government's witnesses.
Which they mostly didn't let them do. As the judge said, I'm not going to let you put the government on trial. Anyway, the jury did, in fact, seize on the self-defense argument. But what was intended to confuse them was that it was not made clear that some of the charges were enhancements on other charges. So the jury found them innocent of the crime, but guilty of using a weapon in the commission of a crime, which is logically inconsistent. You can't be guilty of the enhancement if you're not guilty of the crime. And initially, the judge ruled correctly that those conviction on those points was, he threw them out because they were not logically consistent. But then he reversed himself, and he made them separate crimes and sentenced the Davidians on that basis. So they weren't sentenced for the crime, they were sentenced for an enhancement.
And they got, on average, 40 years each, right?
Yeah, but that was later reduced. Supreme Court eventually reduced the sentences because they weren't allowed, because the jury wasn't allowed to decide that whether or not the weapons were, for example, automatic weapons.
But there are still some of them in prison today, right?
Yes.
And there was also something about an interesting conversation you had with an FBI agent while you were there in San Antonio.
Well, I didn't have it directly. It came to me through another agent. But in conversation, of course, they talk among themselves. He admitted that he had been there, that the burnout of individuals was intentional, and that they did it because for budgetary reasons. The standoff was taking too long, costing too much money. It was tiring out the agents. They wanted to get home to their families, and they didn't want... Of course, they had screwed up a lot. They had a lot of evidence that they wanted to destroy. So the word came down, you know, to just clean up the situation. And that's a spook speak for destroy all the evidence, including, of course, all the witnesses. So then they had to conduct an operation in which to make sure that nobody got out alive. Well, a few did get out alive because the compound was too large to seal all the exits. But what they tried to do is seal all the exits so that nobody could get out, so they'd all burn alive. They first pumped CS gas in, which was flammable, and set it off with ferret rounds, which are incendiary devices.
And they admit, an FBI agent admitted this to another FBI agent who admitted it to you, correct?
Right.
And for the record, the Texas Rangers say that they found incendiary devices at all three origins of the fire. And actually, yes. I must correct you on a technical thing there. The ferret rounds are actually the non-pyrotechnic rounds where the CS is emitted from the tip. There's a separate kind of round, the military rounds that were the incendiary.
Yeah, I did confuse the two there.
That's cool. I just want to make sure about that.
The details are on my website.
And by the way, that website is constitution.org. Let's see, I had a couple of things to ask you real quick. Can you tell me a funny story about correcting the textbooks in the state of Texas? I read some stuff on the internet where it seemed like you were just having a ball going through their government textbooks.
Well, I was. The first one I kind of know, the one main one I kind of seized on, was Magruder's American Government. First put out by a guy named Magruder in 1917, and continued to be published under his name by Prentice Hall, and it's now Prentice Hall, until he died in 1949 when another guy named McClanahan took it over. And McClanahan introduced the use of the term informal amendment to refer to all of the unconstitutional practices that he likes and that he thinks ought to be considered as authoritative as the written Constitution. And, of course, he was teaching it that way. So it's been going on since 1950. So probably the main textbook used in American high schools today. Last year I come along and... Basically, I start picking through the books, not only that one, but the others, phrase by phrase, finding all the ways in which they distort things, including that one. Essentially, I demand, reject the book if they don't remove this, all references to informal amendments, because there are no such things as informal amendments. And pointed out that if it was allowed to stand, then the students would miss a question on the tax test, which asked them to explain how the Constitution is amended. So the publisher was, of course, actually all in favor of changing the book, but his agreement, our contract with authors, didn't let them do that without the author's consent, and the author was balking. And this came right down to the almost the last 2 or 3 minutes before the board had to make a decision. And finally, the author relented, to remove the phrase from the textbook, and the board passed it. So it just goes to show how these things, operate.
Right. All good high school graduates know that Congress can amend the Constitution by a simple majority vote. They just have to pass a law, and the Constitution says whatever we feel like.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the impression they tend to get, and as a result of the changes made to the textbooks last year, they may at least get some doubts about that.
Okay, we've only got 3 minutes left, Mr. Rowland. I want to ask you very quickly about the Anti-Patriot Act resolution that was passed by the Austin City Council last week, or this week, and perhaps you can describe for us... I guess I should make my question specific since we're short on time. There was something in there that forbid the local police from helping federal agents enforce any Patriot Act statutes in Austin. And then, am I correct that that part of it was removed before it was passed?
Well, no, actually the part what the provisions call for was that the any city employees should report any contacts with federal agents pursuant to the Patriot Act.
Okay,
and the Patriot Act itself provides that it is illegal for anyone to disclose that a federal agent has contacted them to enforce it.
Okay, so did they leave that in, or they did take it out?
No, they took it out.
Okay.
They didn't want to put city employees in a conflict with federal agents. But, of course, actually that's what we need to do in order to get the courts to attack that provision. I mean, we need to set ourselves up as a test case.
Absolutely, and of course, it is the job of the city police and the Travis County Sheriff's to protect our lives and liberty from anyone, right?
That's right. We don't do it by not taking a stand and be willing to face prosecution and going to court. And if it takes setting up our own city employees to be the point man for that, then that's what it takes.
John Rowland is the founder of the Constitution Society. You can look him up at constitution.org. It is a treasure trove of all things that you need to know and learn and study in order to understand the Constitution of the United States and what has happened to it. I want to thank you very much for coming on the show today, John.
Well, glad to be on.
This is Ron Paul with the UCI, September 29th. Ambassador Paul Bremer, head of the U.S. Provisional Administration in Iraq, appeared before Congress last week to lobby hard for another $87 billion for nation building. This figure is in addition to the nearly $80 billion we've already spent in Iraq, and the new funding request is for 2004 only. If we stay in Iraq beyond 2004, and the administration has made it clear that reconstruction will be a long-term project, American taxpayers easily could spend $1 trillion over the coming years. The stark reality is that the federal government will fund the open-ended occupation of Iraq either by raising taxes, borrowing overseas, or printing more money. All three options are bad for average Americans. It's important the American people know exactly what they will be paying for in Iraq. The $87 billion request is such a huge sum that it seems meaningless to most of us. Details, however, will astound anyone who resents seeing their tax dollars spent overseas. The following are just some of the administration's requests. $100 million for several new housing communities, complete with roads, schools, and a medical clinic. $20 million for business classes at a cost of $10,000 per Iraqi student. $900 million for imported kerosene and diesel, even though Iraq has huge oil reserves. $54 million to study the Iraqi postal system. $10 million for prison building consultants. $2 million for garbage trucks. $200,000 each for Iraqis in a witness protection program. $100 million for hundreds of criminal investigators and $400 million for two prisons at a cost of nearly $50,000 per bed. I doubt very seriously that most Americans would approve of their tax dollars being used to fund these boondoggles in Iraq. Criticism of this foreign aid spending in Iraq is not restricted to the political left.
Conservative groups and politicians are increasingly angry at the administration's exorbitant spending. For example, Congressman Zach Womp of Tennessee sits on the Appropriations Committee, which is responsible for all spending bills. He has a modest idea, insists that Reconstruction money be paid back as a loan when Iraq's huge oil reserves resume operation. Similarly, Congressman Jeff Flake of Arizona wants to offset every dollar spent reconstructing Iraq with spending cuts in other areas, especially given the amount of wasteful pork in the federal budget. But the White House is adamantly opposed to both ideas. Why is a supposedly conservative administration resistant to even the slightest attempt at fiscal restraint? We have embarked on probably the most extensive nation-building experiment in history. Our provisional authority seeks nothing less than to rebuild Iraq's judicial system, financial system, legal system, transportation system, and political system from the top down, all with hundreds of billions of U.S. tax dollars. We will all pay to provide job training for Iraqis while more and more Americans find themselves out of work. We will pay to secure the Iraqi borders while our own borders remain porous and vulnerable. We will pay for housing, health care, social services, utility, roads, schools, jails, and food in Iraq, leaving American taxpayers with less money to provide these things for themselves at home. We will saddle future generations with billions in government debt. The question of whether Iraq is worth this much to us is one lawmaker should answer now by refusing to approve another nickel for nation building. Thanks for calling the weekly update at 888-322-1414. A new update is available every Monday. The text of this and previous updates can be found at www.house.gov/Paul under the heading entitled Weekly Caller. Thanks for calling.